Feral Audio.
Jimmy Crane's a nerd. Jimmy Crane's an improv nerd. Jimmy Crane's a nerd.
Oh, hey everybody, this is Jimmy Crane, and you're listening to another episode of Improv Nerd, and our guest today is Jonathan Pitts. He is the executive director of the Chicago Improv Festival, where he co-founded it almost 20 years ago with Francis Collier. He is also a teacher, director, performer, improviser. And I'm so excited about this episode because we got an Improv Nerd exclusive about Jonathan's future at the Chicago Improv Festival. He also talked about working with Del Close way back before he even joined the IO Chicago with Sharna and did the Structured Herald. He was working with Del doing an Organic Herald, and he tells us about that. Also, he tells us about his approach to improvisation, which is part Meisner and it's part viewpoints. So I think you're really going to love this episode. Before we get to that, I have sitting on my lap right now Betsy Jane Crane. And she was making some noises before, but now she's really quiet. And I just want to say, for those people that are like, oh, how did Betsy do over Christmas when you flew to Pennsylvania to see Betsy's grandparents? And I want to just say this. Betsy did great. We took her in the airplane, and she was really good. She didn't cry. And then on the way back, she was really good as well. And her dad is getting to be really aggressive with the stroller. I mean, I'll tell you, if you have a stroller and a baby, the world is your oyster, people, because we were waiting before to board on the airplane. And I'm like, you know what? They were calling, you know, the gold members first, right? And first class, when we were boarding the airplane. And I'm like, you know what? We got a baby. We're in group three. I'm always in group three. It doesn't matter what I fly, what airlines I fly, or how much I pay for the ticket. I'm always in group three. So I'm like, you know what? Don't they let babies board free or something? So after they let the military people, which is, they let like eight different groups now board, like blue members and gold members and platinum members and first class and military and chefs. I think chefs usually follow. I just pushed the stroller right up there, and the guy goes, well, usually we don't let them board early because you're in group three, but since you have a stroller and a baby, I'll let you in. And she did great on the way home. The only thing was in the cab ride back, when we landed in Chicago, she cried a little, but that was it. So we did it. We did it. And she got a lot of great toys from her grandparents, which we call Nana and Pooba. Nana and Pooba, we call them that. And I got some great stuff. There's only one thing I didn't get, and I'm not focusing on that because, you know, I'm a changed man in 2017. All right, enough about me. You're going to love this episode. You're going to love it, Betsy. You really are going to love it. Here it is, the Jonathan Pitts episode. Enjoy.
Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd, oh yeah. Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd.
And I think you said that your grandfather made fun of you for wanting to play.
Yes.
And he would say, you know, life isn't about playing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what was that like for you when you took your first improv class? You were in college, and now you're allowed to play after probably many times getting this lecture from your grandfather.
Yeah, it served as a gigantic affirmation. Like, oh, yes, I am right. It is fine to play. As a kid, I remember, you know, after a certain point, it used to be like, play, play, play. That's all you do is play. Life is not about play. And this is the same man who, before he started drinking again, told my mom to be gentle with me because I had so much spirit, you know. But then, he was very mentally and emotionally abusive. He was really good at humiliation, and he was really good at long, long lectures. And yet, as a kid, I loved to play. You know, I personally believe that to play is a divine right of being human, that it's one of the things that belong to us as a species. And when I finally took that first class at Second City...
What year was this?
This would have been 1980.
Okay.
In the Paleolithic era of improv.
When nothing was organized.
Nothing.
And basically you were taking a workshop from Alan Bernholtz had...
Alan Baranowski, not Alan Bernholtz.
Right.
That's Ike's.
Ike's father.
Yeah.
He had taken this over from Dell, right?
Yes, because and I didn't know this at the time, but Dell was in rehab.
Mm-hmm. So this is the first time you go to the you take this workshop, which was like 13 weeks or something.
Yeah.
It was on Thursday.
Back then, there was no Second City Training Center. There was no Second City ETC. There was only one touring company. There was no IO, no Annoyance, no Comedy Sports, no places.
No formal training at all.
No, and there was no training center at Second City. So back then, like, they had four workshops a year. Each one went 13 weeks.
And they made on Thursday nights and then Saturday for 4 hours.
Saturday for 4 hours, Thursday for two.
What did you like about that when you...
It felt more like an apprenticeship. You know, it felt like... in those early years studying that way, getting that larger, longer exposure to a point of view really felt more like, oh, this is a craft and I'm learning from a craftsman and this feels like an apprenticeship. And that made a lot more sense to me than 3 hours a week for 8 weeks and then move on to somebody else.
Which didn't even exist back then.
No, it didn't. Nothing.
And then the other thing I found interesting was you said it took you a couple weeks before you got a laugh. So
yes.
I'm interesting is like, because people at an improv, we all, because I started probably in 82, somewhere around there. We knew we were there to get laughs.
Right.
So what was it like for you, like not to get laughs and then eventually get laughs? What kept you keep coming back?
Because it was still fun to play. I mean, just the simplicity of it was fun to play. The first class that I went to, I sat in the seats by the upper row.
It was in the main stage of Second City.
Yeah, there was
right.
no other stage.
Right.
It was the only stage. It wasn't the main stage. It was the only stage. So I sat in there and watched all these smart, interesting people playing. And I was in there watching, thinking, oh, if it was me, I'd say this, I'd say that. And I just wanted to go back because I was so excited by it. Because, you know, it had emotional scenes, social satire, political satire. You know, it really looked like parts of Saturday Night Live, but improvised. And so I was like, this looks like a lot of fun. I think I can do it. And then when I went up the next week, all those thoughts that I had sitting out of it.
All the things you had planned.
Or even I was like, oh, this would be easy to say.
Right, right.
Just look in the eye and say this. And instead I was like, I was up there and I had nothing or I didn't know or it was moving at such a faster pace being in it versus sitting out and watching it. But that was fine because I was still just glad to be there. Because again, here's all these adults, all of them older than me because I was only 20 years old, playing and being given authorization to play. And it was so the opposite of like, you know, my grandfather's beliefs as a scientist and a lawyer and stuff like that, that I was like, this is super fun. And the first couple of weeks, I was planning what as opposed to responding, exactly what you had said. But it was like always behind the eight ball and, you know.
The other thing is, when Dell came back to take over the workshop,
right.
This is the first time you're exposed to what... The Organic Herald. And this is way before he pairs up with Sharna.
Way before.
And does the I.O. What was the Herald like when he was doing it in those workshops?
Well, and these are also what he taught Alan Baranowski. So Alan Baranowski was teaching the Organic, what's now called the Organic Herald. So I had actually learned the Organic Herald from Alan before I ever came across and was exposed to it through Dell. But back then... There were like three or four main openings, but each opening was to generate as many different ideas and thoughts about it as the suggestion as possible. And the idea back then was to dive into the suggestion, not use it as a starting point to move away from. So you would get thematic concerns, like maybe a theme would be transportation. And everyone would stop and go, and every time someone stop and go, they would say something related to transportation, either directly or indirectly. And then as it built up enough sort of head of steam, eventually a scene would break out of all these different ideas, thoughts, references, slogans being said. And then a lot of times that same information would be reincorporated into the Improvisational Herald. And also back then, there was no structure to the Herald.
So there was no opening, three scenes a game, three scenes
none of
a
that.
Game, then three scenes, try to tie it all together.
Yeah, none of that. It was like you would make up your own patterns and your own scene format as you went, because the whole time you're exploring the theme. So it, you could do a monologue, you could do two-person scenes, group scenes, whatever you wanted to do off of that suggestion, but there was never any structure. Callbacks, if they happened, happened organically. Returning to scenes happened if they happened organically. The biggest thing was you were constantly pursuing and exploring the theme. And then as you did that, patterns would emerge, and then you would sort of skate along with those patterns. And then at a certain point, that point was never predetermined, you would know that you'd reached the end of the sort of the arc of the whole piece, and then that was it.
And I would imagine the length could go be 20 minutes,
yep.
It could be an hour and a half.
Exactly. Yes.
Now, another person that you got to work with besides Del Close, and you work with many great people, was David Shepherd, a guy mm-hmm. who doesn't seem to get his due in a lot of respects. And he was one of the original founders, co-founders of Second City, and he later founded the Improv Olympic with Sharna. Was that?
He created Improv Olympic first in New York. And then he did it for years in New York. Then he went up to Toronto and did it up in Toronto. And then he came to Chicago. And then when he came to Chicago creating the Improv Olympic, he hired two people to be like assistant producers for him, Mark Halifant and Sharna Halpert.
And then when you're working with him at the Improv Olympic here in Chicago, you guys are doing short form games. I think he had like 10 short form games.
There were 10 games. They're all Olympic themed, like story throw, song put, work put, song cycle. They all had. He also created Time Dash, which is the
moving the scene forward.
Yeah.
Something
you know,
is
space jump.
It could be a year, it could be 2 hours,
right.
It could, but the scene goes forward.
Yeah. And when you say at Improv Olympic, I want to make clear to everybody, there was not an Improv Olympic space. You know, they had the Improv Olympic. This is back when it was a competition and there were two leagues. There was the amateur league and the pro league. And the matches would take place in different bars and venues. So there was no, because when people hear Improv Olympic now, they think of the singular space where Sharna's got four theaters and or the prior space on Clark. Back then, Improv Olympic was a lot of different places doing different shows on different nights.
And they were doing these short form games,
yep.
That they were being judged on by the
yes.
audience. And there was actually a competition.
Actual judges. The judges, audience didn't vote.
Okay.
It was like judges who gave out points for each round, mm-hmm. and there were like 5 rounds.
What was working with David Shepherd like?
Well, as everybody knows, he's bipolar, but back then no one knew that he was bipolar. So he had this history of charging into a new idea filled with all this energy, and then when it worked, he would become disenchanted with it. Which and when it you know when he's creating the idea, everything's fantastic. When the idea has been created, everything sucks, which fits the overall arc of anybody with you know bipolar. So when he was putting all that energy into that first season of Improv Olympic, everybody was excited by it, and there were you know like Sheldon Patinkin had a group of students that you know represented from him. I was on Stone Soup, which was sort of Dell's group. And then Don DiPolo had a group and Vern Piven had a group. So they're all on the pro levels. There are all these people representing the different sensei masters, as you would. And then the amateur teams or collections of people with shared interests, like the group of rabbis was the God Squad and the group of lawyers was Magnum Farce. So you had all these competitions, but on the pro level, everybody took it seriously because we were not only fighting for our, you know, playing for our name, we're also playing for the name of our master, you know. And so, like, when each team would play, it's like, you know, it wasn't just that we were playing against Jeremy Piven, it's that we were playing against Jeremy Piven's folks.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a different level of energy to it. And also, David was so excited about this wide range of population committing its energy, because he was always wanted in a populist theater for everyone to be able to have their voice and be able to communicate their voice and share their real life concerns. That tended to happen more with the amateur groups than the pro groups, Because the pro groups are all people that wanted to be trained as actors or
hopefully be hired by Second City and then Saturday Night Live. That trajectory.
Yeah, yeah, right.
Now, so you study in Chicago for about 10 years. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually you move away with your girlfriend to New Mexico.
Actually, it was like 5 years.
5 years.
Yeah.
And then you move to New Mexico.
Right.
And after a few years, the group gets into a disagreement and you return back to Chicago and you get into therapy.
Yes.
And your therapist says something that changes how you approach your work. What was it that he said?
He said, can you be happy if you give up? If meaning, oh, I fucked that up. Let me try that again. I was trying to like sell it before I
right.
said it. So
okay.
My apologies.
All right.
He said, if it means being happy, can you give up theater? If your own, do you value your own happiness more than you value doing theater? And that was a hell of a question. And
what was your response at the time?
Shock, because it, you know. But that's why I knew it was a good question,
because mm-hmm.
it really sort of like exploded inside me. And I didn't have an answer for that. And because I didn't have an answer for that, I knew it was something I had to explore. And so I spent about 2 years not doing theater at all, not doing anything. And
what did you do?
Part-time jobs.
Okay.
You know, just, I worked for a singing telegram company, you know, and then spent a lot of time in different recovery programs and also different therapy. And there are a lot of things that I gained out of it, part of which was that I had the discovery of that unknowingly, unconsciously, I'd been treating the audience to be my replacement father. I was looking for them to give me the affirmation that I really wanted from my father, who I grew up without and only saw one day a year, and he was a professional entertainer. And I wanted the audience to give me that approval that I wanted from my father, that approval and validation. And I realized how unfair that was, because no audience was ever buying a ticket with that in mind.
You make a good point, because I think a lot of people, I know I struggle with this, wanting the audience to approve them, to validate them. How did you let go of that?
Well, that took a while, because once I made that discovery, I'm like, holy crap, you know, the audience doesn't know it. They're my father replacement, and that's not fair to them. That's not fair to me. So what do I do? How do I do this? And I was like, so what is my relationship with the audience? What is my relationship with this work? What is my relationship with myself doing it? And that was really challenging. And I remember the next time I got up to perform, how scary it was, because I didn't know where the boundaries were. I didn't know what the pursuit was. I didn't really necessarily know who or what I was in that situation, or what I was trying to get with them or from them. And so then I backed away and didn't perform again for a while. And I kept doing more inner work. And what came out of that inner work, obviously the obvious answer, and I'm sure anyone's listening is screaming, is that most audiences just want to be entertained. That's what they're paying their ticket for, is to be entertained, or to be informed, or to see something they've never seen before and have the joy of discovery. And that's really what they're paying for on their side. And I was like, that's when I started looking at, oh, for me then, what I'm looking out of the experience with any audience is to think of them almost like partners. Like they were in this journey together, and we're on different parts of the journey. We have different duties within this journey, but we're sharing this journey together. And they do their part, I do mine, and then we see what happens. You know, my metaphor is it's like mountain climbing in public. You know, if I perform, would I perform even if there was no one there? Like if you climb a mountain, you climb it for your own purposes, and it requires all your attention and focus in order to succeed at it. Otherwise, you fall off the mountain. But there happens to be people either following you or watching you. And so you have to be aware of them and bring them along, but you can't climb that mountain for them, because then you're not paying attention to the mountain. And to me, then I changed my focus of the arts became the partner, became the muse. That's who the real partnership was with, sort of similar to hearing painters talk about their relationship with the canvas, or sculptors with what they're sculpting. You know, the interconnection is between them, and then other people afterwards have a different reaction and response to it.
And speaking of partners, you found a great partner in Francis Collier.
Great segue.
Thank you very much. And that was almost 20 years ago.
Yes.
1997. And you started the Chicago Improv Festival.
Mm-hmm.
And over all the years, is there one performance of the 20 years that you've done this that sticks out to you?
Like when you asked that question, there were like five or six images, and I'm trying to shrink it down.
Great. So give me the five, but give me really short the five that came to you. First image.
After 9/11, when we had the group from Tel Aviv come perform, because dealing with terrorism and bombs was so new to us, so to have an improv group that dealt with improvising about what it's like to live in that way every day, the exchange of that between the audience and them, that was amazing.
Great. Second vision. Second thing.
Yellow Man Group, all performing in yellow costumes, doing the yellow gestures of because they had three gestures for Yellow Man Group. And
Yellow Man Group is from
Tokyo, Japan.
And do it in silence?
They performed
English
bilingually.
Okay,
yeah,
great.
Kind of, yeah. And then, you know, another one was when we had Jason Chin being flown off stage with the IO team, and it ended with a Superman type scene, and he was Superman, and everyone in the cast flew him off stage, and that was such a beautiful moment on several levels. The end of the Annoyance show that Mick Napier had happen here at the Athenaeum, when he put a lot of energy into defining and working with the cast to develop the show, and they end the show by going to the edge of the orchestra pit, and they all throw their chairs into the pit. It was sort of like the punk rock version of destroying your guitar afterwards, especially since the chair is such a symbol for improv and sketch.
As a producer, I'd be like, oh, fuck. You know, I hope no one gets
hurt.
We already
had it cleared out ahead
of
time.
Okay, great. All right.
So no one was down there.
Okay,
we knew. We even had pads out, and then it was their chairs.
Good.
It wasn't ours.
Good.
So, you know, yeah.
Great. And is there a moment of the 20 years that you're the most proud of?
I don't have an answer to that yet because, you know, CIF 20, I almost feel like I'll have to be away from it for a while because since they're still going into the next one, it's like what sports guys say that you need to like be done with your career mm-hmm. in order to look back and see what pops out the most.
Mm-hmm.
Just generally, maybe the thing I'm most proud of is the first year that we did it, the very first night, me and Francis being in the, you know, Annoyance Theater that was normally only hold 200 people, but we reconfigured it and had 300 people. And we had the Improv Institute, you know, have a reunion to perform. We had Upright Citizens Brigade perform, and they just gotten their award at the U.S. Comedy Arts Festival.
This is before they have a TV show
yep.
and before they have
yep.
the New York and L.A. school and theater.
Yeah, and so on opening night, we had 300 people, and it proved that this works and that this was right. So that was probably...
So your proudest moment was a fire hazard?
Yes, it was.
How do you keep doing it? Because... How do you keep doing it?
I was ready to quit after year 15.
Are you serious?
I was planning on quitting.
Okay.
You know, I was going to quit after year 15.
Were you burnt out?
I felt like I'd made my... I burned out around year 9 or 10.
Okay.
And then year 9 was a really rough year, and I'm like, well, I'm not going
to... What was... No, with the festival, what was
yeah.
rough about it?
It was the first year that I turned things over to everybody else,
mm-hmm.
and so many things went wrong. It's very funny. Afterwards, Joyce Sloan said to me, "You delegated too much.
You delegated too much,
yes.
Jonathan."
And I was like, I laughed, but she was right. So I was like, okay, I'm going to stick around for year 10 because I don't, if this festival comes to an end, I'd rather come to an end at my hands rather
right.
than someone else's.
Right.
And so then year 10 happened, and then along the way, like, made it to year 15. And year 15, I'm like, I'm done. I've made my contribution. You know, this has felt like a burden in a good way, like, you know, a burden for the Chicago improv community, my contribution to the community, the improv community as a whole. I feel like I've done this. I've made my contribution. I am ready to move on. And I was actively looking at another city to move to. And then that's when my mom had a massive stroke, and I'm an only child. And from a divorced home, there was no one else to take care of her other than me. So the next 2 years of my life, was spending a lot of time overseeing her health care and her financial care. And then after she passed away, which doesn't mean that I did a bad job. And after she,
what do you mean that? Like you got punished?
I was thinking, you know, no, I was thinking more like, you know, well, if you're doing such a good job taking care of her, why'd she die 2 years later? But, you know, she had a vascular dementia, which most people are gone within 36 months, and she was gone with 20. So most of that time was playing for a tie, like using all my resources to give her, because there was no way to win, but to give her a good time that she had, as long as she had time, and as good of an exit as possible. And then after that, then it took 2 years to wrap up her estate. I spent a lot of time rehabbing her house. It took about a year rehabbing her house that I inherited. It's 42 miles away, so I'm not going to live there, but I wanted to rehab it so that another family could live there, you know, and that sort of felt like a spiritual journey. That's done. And I was ready to go. But I'm like, year 19, that seems silly not to wait for one more year. It, you know.
So do we have an exclusive, this is your last year? Is this an Improv Nerd exclusive?
Yeah, this is going to be my last year.
Okay. What do you have planned for it, for yourself?
You mean for year 20 or post?
For year 20 and for yourself to celebrate you.
I have a lot of people that I'm planning on, that I'm going to ask if they can come in and do
it. I would use it, Jonathan. I would use it and say, this is my last year. And you got to come in for this.
Yeah. I mean, I'm turning it the festival over to someone else, mm-hmm. but she still works within the organization. Mm-hmm.
Is that Jessie?
Yeah, Jessie. Oh, she's going to take
Jessie Kunin.
Yeah.
She's great.
Right?
Yeah. She's,
that's why.
She's, yeah.
Right. That's.
Yeah. He's. Well, she's the photographer for
yes.
Improv.
Right? Yeah.
She's, yeah. She's I just great. Love her. Yeah.
So that's why I was like, because, yeah, she's fantastic.
Okay.
That's why I'm comfortable with turning this over to her.
Mm-hmm. Do you really turn it over? I mean, like, you're going to give her the keys and you're going to, that's it? Or are you gonna...
That's what I'm planning to do. Same thing with our college improv tournament.
Okay.
This year is our 10th year.
Are you going to give me something right now?
As far as like things I'm turning over?
Yeah.
I'll see what
think
I can
about it. Yeah. I don't want to pin you down. I'm just glad
but
we
I'm
got the
our college improv tournament, tournament over right. to Ricky Hashmeyer after year 10. And I'm hopefully going to find somebody who can replace me as the executive director, because I didn't start off doing improv or art or theater to be an executive director. It's just the title that comes with being an not-for-profit.
Well, I often wonder too. It's like you started it. You wanted to be a performer. I mean, there's no question about it. The last 20 years, you're known as the executive director
right.
of CIF. And I'm like, well, when I did this research, I was surprised about how extensive you studied this, you know?
Right.
Because I knew you as just basically as a
right.
producer. How do you, what do you want to do now when you no longer have to produce as much?
Well, if I'm able to do that, what I want to do is still remain the artistic director of this organization
mm-hmm.
and be able to help with the programs, because I'm really good at creating programs and developing programs and maintaining them. I'm not necessarily a great executive director. Like as a creator producer, on a scale of 1 to 10, I'm probably a 9.
Mm-hmm.
As an executive director, on a scale of 1 to 10, I'm probably a 4. And there are other people out here who's getting funders and donors and all that. That's their jam.
Right.
That's not me. And so I want to sit there, if I can remain, still be involved with this organization, be somebody who's not here 6 months out of the year, because 6 months out of the year, I'm traveling to other countries, either teaching improv workshops or doing improv shows or developing improv shows with other people in other countries. Or other places across the United States. My joke is I want to be Randy Dixon. Randy Dixon is the artistic director of Unexpected Productions in Seattle, and he's one of those people that isn't that well known outside of Seattle, but everyone loves him all over the rest of the world. And so it's like that seems like a lot of fun to me. And being able to create new shows, being able to create unscripted theater, not just comedic shows, but dramatic improvisational shows. Those are the things that I'm interested in. You know,
we got to take a quick break. We're going to be right back after this. We'll continue our discussion with Jonathan Pitts, who has just given us an exclusive here. It is his last year of CIF. We'll be right back.
And we're back. And Jonathan just corrected me. It's Jonathan's last year of CIF, but it is not the last year of the Chicago Improv Festival. That is being turned over in great hands with Jesse Kunath. So right. I'm glad I corrected that.
Because otherwise, there'll be so many people in Chicago planning their own improv festivals to replace this.
Right. But let's talk about something that I think is really interesting, because 20 years ago, there was not many improv festivals. I can think of a couple offhand.
There weren't.
Not only that, there wasn't what was going on in New York and Los Angeles with the UCB and Pitt, the Magnet. I.O. opened up a shop there. And also, all in small cities now, not only have an improv theater, they also have an improv festival. If you have a zip code, you have an improv festival, pretty much.
Right.
So what do you tell people that still need to come to Chicago to study improv? Do they?
If they want to either study in Mecca, because that's always been the thing, no matter what changes, this will always be the historical birthplace of this art form. If they want to study in the birthplace of it, there's only Chicago. But otherwise, if you want to study with the specific theaters, like, and get that training, can you get, you know, you can mainly, I mean, obviously now Annoyance is training here and in New York, but Mick is here. And I.O. has I.O. here and I.O. West, but Noah Gregoropoulos is here. And, you know, Second City is mainly here, and that's more for sketch, but there's also Comedy Sports. I mean, there's like so many different training centers now. I think there's like 7 training centers now. And then there's also all the post-grad classes that people do, like Dina Fackus and Kevin Mullaney and you. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that's a great thing that's being done too. So, but I think most people that move here because this is their career path to TV. And I feel like that's one of the things that's been a huge change is that, you know, maybe, because I remember back in the day when we took, there was an audition that I was a part of, the Dell said to everybody, how many people here want to be part of Saturday Night Live? And it was like an audition with maybe 100 people. And I'd say a third of the people raised their hand. He kicked them out. They were out of the audition. They were done. And, you know, because even though he had all of that, he wanted people who were training to be artists. You know, because that was the word that he used a lot of back then, was being an artist. Or being sort of like a comedy gorilla or a comedic shaman. I mean, now there's so much improv being taught to so many people, which is great because you have better people. But what I have not seen, even though I see the huge proliferation of improv students, and to give people a frame of reference, there are 22 theaters right now in Chicago that do improv. That doesn't include the bars or people that rent theaters. There are 22 venues that have a sign on their door saying they do improv. And that doesn't include the 5 in the suburbs. And of those 22, when you include the multiple stages, you're looking at like, you know, Second City has 7 stages. I.O. has 4. 4 years ago, there were only 10 spaces in the whole city of Chicago that did improv. Now there's 22.
Well, the other interesting thing is not only has the stages expanded, but all these training centers has expanded.
Right.
Annoyance has.
Right.
I.O. has. Second City has done this huge expansion.
Right.
Who are these students? Because when we started, it was a very specific path. You were an artist, but you really wanted to be on Saturday Night Live. That was your end goal.
Right.
Who are taking all these classes?
I don't know. You know, that's... And for me, what I've seen is, as much as everything else has grown, the audience base going to see the shows has not grown in equal proportion. And that...
What's the danger there?
It could be like San Francisco, where you have so many venues and not enough audience, paying audiences to keep it going, that, you know, will there be a collapse of a lot of this? Because it's great to have students involved, it's great to have students paying, but to me, ultimately, it's playing to people that are not you that create the connection of a live performance.
Which is something that Mick addressed in his book, and I've been lucky enough to tour around the country and see this as well. It doesn't, like, short form seems to have found an audience. I think Comedy Sports does a great job. If you ever go to Comedy Sports, you see it's not an, it is a mainstream audience.
Right.
Improv Shakespeare does the same thing. Yep. It's a mainstream audience. I think TJ and Dave does that. I think musical improv is touched on that.
Right.
But long form still seems to be dependent on long form students to support the show. How does long form reach a bigger audience, a more mainstream audience?
By the using, my guess would be by using some of the same things that regular theaters do, which is audience development. I mean, when we first created the Chicago Improv Festival, Francis and I had slightly different viewpoints as to what we wanted to create. Francis was in charge of the Second City Training Center. So at the time, she wanted the Chicago Improv Festival to be mainly workshops over the weekend with only a sporadic amount of performances. I wanted it to be majority performances with only a certain amount of workshops. And then we met somewhere in the middle, because the first year we had weekend workshops, and we were doing intensives back then before, it seemed like before other people were doing weekend long intensive. Mm-hmm. Now everyone does. But back then, that was our mid-grow. And then as those weekend intensives grew really popular in around the city, then I just put more and more energy into the performances, because I felt as a festival, you know, you got to ask the question, who is the festival for? And, you know, I think that sometimes some improv festivals are not really festivals, but they're conferences or they're showcases, or, well, no, they're not even showcases. They're conventions, you know, instead of like a group of plumbers getting together.
But what's wrong with the convention?
Nothing.
Mm-hmm.
But a festival is for someone, to me, there's a difference, because a festival is for the audience. You are, you know, traditionally when, not just improv festivals, festivals as a whole, even going back to their, you know, religious nature, it is this ceremony between people that are priests or acting out a play or something, you know, like a street play, being given to the surrounding members of the community and the community at large, rather than the community of a specific focus. There is nothing wrong with a convention, but and that's what I think most improv festivals are, is they're conventions where 75% of the people in attendance are other improvisers, and they make for really great shows because everyone gets to see what you're doing and they understand it and they applaud it. But how do you get a regular audience to be more aware of long form as its own valid theatrical art form that's worth paying for? That requires audience development the same way that putting up a theatrical season does with scripted theater, the same way that, like, the New Year Futurists have created and found their audience. And that means putting as much money and time and energy into developing your audience and connecting with your audience as it does creating, developing your improvisers.
Now, you, during the year, you also travel around the country, mm-hmm. and probably the world right now?
Not as much around the world lately, but I'm going to be going around the world later this year.
What sort of trends do you see in improv? Like, what are people doing well that you see that is a constant pattern, and what people struggle with?
What I'm seeing outside of the United States, and in some places like Seattle and Austin, Texas, is a lot more narrative improv that is incorporating long form and making a, you know, narrative story based improv incorporating long form and creating really exciting stuff, more than I see long form incorporating influences like narrative and story, which is separate, because I'm sure you could sit there and immediately say, well, all improvised Shakespeare does is a complete play, and there's other examples of complete plays, or things like what you did with Naked, with Stephanie.
It's everywhere.
Yeah, and so but in terms of like where I see a lot of the groups doing, because it used to be that Keith Johnstone owned all of Europe and Canada and Mexico, but got nowhere in the United States, except for, you know, maybe Seattle. And now a lot of those groups have also been taking classes with long form. So they're incorporating that. And so I'm seeing them have more influence on that. Whereas in America, it seems like more people are being influenced by the current UCB style.
What do you see people struggling with? Like, I know when I teach improv across the country, if you ask me what pattern that comes to mind, people will monologue stuff. We were taught one line at a time, back and forth, like
sure.
a ping
yeah,
pong
yeah.
game. What are you seeing that people are struggling with? That seems consistent, you know.
That's a great question.
Mm-hmm.
And apologizing for stalling, I was trying to like find a way to how to phrase it in the way that I want to phrase it. What I see people struggling with is the sense of awareness that they're an improviser. One of the things that's wonderful about being an actor is you know you're an actor. So you have that kind of protection and awareness as to what you'll commit to. You're an actor whether or not you're doing a Shakespeare piece or a Neil Simon play or you're doing something, you know, like a Sam Shepard play. You're still an actor, but you're applying yourself differently based on the different plays that you're in. Whereas improvisers, maybe it's because of the, you know, truth and comedy aspect of it, there's not sort of like an artistic armor for them to be able to realize, I can choose to dive into this because it's a choice to dive into this murky waters.
What you're talking about is when the improviser comes off stage, maybe they've done something that's not politically correct.
Yeah.
Maybe they've done something that's really dark, and they come off and say, oh, to the audience, meaning the people in the workshop or the class, that's not really who I am.
Right.
And I really didn't go, I kind of freaked out up there.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. What do you tell people that struggle with that? Because I think a lot of improvisers struggle with it. I know I struggle with it because you're not protected by someone else's words. They're your words. And
right.
you feel if you're going to do that, you play a racist character, a misogynist character,
right.
you're going to be judged for that.
Right. And now I feel like I'm promoting myself, so I apologize for that. But
please do. This is...
I hope I'm doing okay in this.
I think you're doing fine.
I rarely do podcasts, and so I don't know.
Well, we're honored that you are doing ours.
Okay. After Martin DeMott died,
mm-hmm.
I had a dream in which I was teaching a workshop because I was struggling with teaching in Second City, going, how do you get people to get to the point of scenic commitment and scenic exploration that seems to take most people 100 shows underneath their belt in order to get there? So how can they get there faster? And then after he died, like 2 or 3 months later, I had a dream in which I was teaching this workshop, and I woke up and I was like, that would work. And I've been doing it ever since, and I call the workshop the Marty. And it incorporates elements of Meisner,
mm-hmm.
and it also incorporates elements of viewpoints, you know. And really what it was is that mainly I work with people to realize somebody just said something to you. You have a real physical response to it. It's in your body. Because even though we're playing a game or pretend, we still, as a human species, have a visceral response. Whether or not I look at you and say, you have lovely eyes because they're so soulful. Or whether or not I look at you and say, you know, you got to get out of my office. Whatever it is, you have some sort of visceral response. That's a truth that's in your that you can choose to use or choose not to use. And that's...
So take the thing, you look at me and you say, you got to get out of my office. Now... Where do we go from there?
That depends on how you choose to respond to it.
Mm-hmm.
And part of what I try to, in the workshop, I also have people, after they hear the line of dialogue, walk off stage and then downstage where the rest of the class is and say what they heard and how they heard it. They themselves, they the human being, they the improviser, because a lot of times people get so caught up in scenes, it's the character who's taken over the scene. Or it's the moment versus like, because to me, listening is so paramount. And when you have listening, you need to be able to listen to the other person and hear them in a dispassionate, compassionate way to really get the fullness of the gift they've given you. And you need to listen to yourself because there's so much gift within your own response. If I don't listen to you, we've missed half of what this moment could be. If I don't listen to myself, we miss what half of this moment can be. But that also involves recognizing, oh, this moment might make me feel terror, but it's okay because when I look in Jimmy's eyes, I still see, this is my scene partner, this is my buddy. We are on the same team. The only way you can have characters in conflict is if the improvisers are in connection underneath. And by having that awareness, this is still a big game of pretend. So you terrorizing me, if that's what happened in the moment, is a wonderful gift. And then it's up to me as an artist, as an improviser, to choose how do I want to use this moment. Do I want to lean into it or do I want to lean away from it? And that's 100% my choice. And then when you have people operating at that level, if something becomes painful, you can just choose not to deal with it, like push it to the side, kind of like improv jujitsu. After my mom died, I do a show sometimes with the Second City Teachers. And after my mom died, and everyone there knew that my mom had died. And it was sort of like the elephant in the room. And all these teachers wanted to like say something nice or compassionate, which, you know, I really understood. And then during the show, there were like five scenes dealing with mom's death. You know, not my mom's death, just the topic of mom's death, including a couple that I was in. And it was still too fresh or new to me to want to engage into it. So I knew how to be able to still hear what's been said, not take it personally, not, you know, still. And then, you know, instead of leaning into it, lean away from it and made the moment change. I feel like there, whatever that is, because you started saying it really well. So I support that. That recognition that improvisers can have, that can protect them so that they can make more, some sort of protection for an improviser so they can make more unprotected choices. And to me, part of that comes from recognizing you're an improviser first. You know, well, actually, you're a human being first. But, you know, because Paul's still saying, wear a character like you would, as lightly as you would a straw hat, be ready to reveal yourself. But you're a human being first. You're the improviser second. Everything else is the puppet show or the mask that we put on for this moment. And when I work with people on that, they feel, they get empowered to become stronger, to make their own choices, to make their own connections. And they, you know, and it reminds me of some of the work you do with slow comedy. They then really hear and take apart the moment. And there's so few wasted words. And it becomes that improv ecology that Del was aiming for, because then everything matters. And then when everything matters, so that to me is what's missing to some degree, because
in improv today?
Yeah, because you're talking about, like, you know, people, like, they do a scene and they walk off and they apologize or whatever, and they, you know, or they may even be told, you went too far, or whatever it might be. So how do we, as improv artists, have the ability to explore humanity and being human in all its range of wonderfulness to awfulness? Unless we're able to give each other that permission.
And is that getting harder to do today?
It seems to be.
Okay.
Yeah, it seems to be. You know, from what I've been reading online and what people are talking about and what people are interested in, it seems to be, because, you know, which is why I think that maybe some of the theaters are trying to come up with HR performer policies or whatever, because they're trying to find a way to create that safety net. Because again, as you said, you know, unlike theater, where you have a stage manager, you have a director, you have a script, you have all these safe words in place, mm-hmm. per se, and, you know, you can try it again and work it out again. And I think that somehow, I guess, you know, if it were up to me, I would have more improvisers geared towards finding the yes within themselves to make the choice that they want to make in the moment, rather than the yes to the training program that they've received. Because, and I understand it, because when I first was new, you know, started doing improv, whatever you say is improv, that's what I want to do. Because as a student, ultimately, I want you to tell me I'm doing good.
Well, basically, you're talking about finding your voice.
Yes, absolutely. Yes. Yeah.
We've got to wrap this up. A couple really quick things. Anything big that's coming up for CIF that we should know about?
Well, with Chicago Improv Productions on February 25th, we're doing our 10th annual College Improv Tournament National Championship. Mm-hmm. We have 16 teams from across the country, because we do 15 regionals, and these are the 15 regional champs plus one wildcard team. And they're going to be doing that. And then after that, the next big thing is the Chicago Improv Festival,
March 27th through April 2nd.
And what are you going to do for you? What are you going to do to make this your last hurrah?
There are a lot of people in a lot of different shows that I'm sending out invitations to.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's like fishing. You with so many people involved.
Are you using the suggestion about like, hey, this is my last
hurrah? Oh, yeah. That's definitely going to be part of what I'm going to be sending out to people. Okay. Just so that they know. Because who knows? They might be like...
I think you should get an award. You've given out a lot of awards. How about you get an award?
Well, it would feel weird to give myself an award.
I'd be happy to present it to you. Yeah. We could come up with it right now if you'd like. because I have a feeling, and this is just me, that you're not going to honor yourself in this.
Huh. Maybe. You know, in a lot of ways, the Improv Festival has felt like something that I was doing more for other people than doing for myself.
Right.
So I know that like after the festival is closed, a week or two later, I'm going off to a friend of mine. She's getting married in England. I'm going off there and then I'll probably stay out in Europe for a while. Like that to me is like what I'm doing for me.
Right.
I want to put together an unscripted theater company to do unscripted work and put up shows. That's for me. I've always sort of felt like the festival was an act of service and for the community and the place that I've come from.
Okay. So, I would just like to see you honor yourself in some way. And if yes.
And I do duly hear that.
Okay.
And I'm one of those people that as I hear something, and it's similar to what I said when my therapist said that, I hear that and I'm like, I don't know. So I'll be spending the next 2 months with that spinning in my
head. Because what I do is like I minimize what I've done. You've done this for 20 years. You've built this great thing, you know.
Yeah, because you've offered up this idea and thought, it probably will have an impact. And then I will, somewhere down the road, have an answer to that. I don't have an answer for that
today. I've got to let go of the results. I definitely have to resolve it, but I can be controlling, as you know. We end each podcast with the same question, and that is, what piece of advice would you give to somebody starting out in improv today?
Go to a bunch of shows of different theaters and see which one resonates inside you. And then go work with them. Whether or not you're taking classes there, whether or not you're painting their doors and helping out. See who speaks to you and go speak to them.
Jonathan Pitts, thank you so much for being our guest on this episode of Improv Nerd. And there you have it. Another episode of Improv Nerd is in the can. And can you believe we got an exclusive? Maybe it's my old public radio, a journalistic aggressiveness or competitiveness, but I'm so glad. I don't think any other media outlet has gotten this story. We got it first here at Improv Nerd about this being Jonathan Pitts' last year as the executive director of the Improv Festival. And he's turning it over to Jesse Kuneth, which, as you know, and we mentioned this in the episode, she was the photographer and just a great person for Improv Nerd. I also want to thank the whole staff of Improv Nerd for making this happen. Dan Schiffmacher, my producer, the director, Sam Bowers, and Ian Getz. I hope I got your last name right. Ian, who came along to help record this episode. If you want more information about me, Jimmy Corain, and my award-winning classes, workshops, and intensives, The Artist Low Comedy, go to my slick website, jimmycorain.com. Also, follow us on social media. That is Facebook. Like us on our fan page because it really helps with my low self-esteem. Follow us on Twitter, improv_nerd. And then go to our YouTube channel. Please subscribe. Dan Schiffmacher and Sam Bowers, they're doing a great job with that YouTube channel. So just check that out. You get to see clips from our live shows, or if we do an interview and we videotape it, you get to see the guests and me, and it's great. It's really super educational. We're also lucky to be part of a podcast collective called Feral Audio. They've got some of the hottest comedy podcasts out there, including this one. So check that out at feralaudio.com. And of course, I can't do this, Betsy. Betsy, she's just squirming now, but I love this little baby. I love this little baby. She might have pooped. I'm smelling something that might be pooped. She's been working on pooping, and we get very excited when she poops around here. So I want to thank you for listening, and until next time, remember, walk, don't run. All right, Betsy, we got it.
Hello, I'm Kyle Ayers. I'm the host of Never Seen It, the podcast where comedians rewrite famous movies and TV shows they've never seen, and then we give them a read in studio. This is a clip I want to play for you guys from an episode where Langston Kerman rewrites Scarface. He's never seen it, but he wrote a script based on what he thinks he knows about it. And here's a clip. Give it a listen.
All right. Scarface, The New Frontier. Interior, happening discotheque. Remember when we called clubs discotheques? LOL. The 70s were crazy. Night. The crowd bustles with young, hot Mexicans who are supposed to be Cuban and all are dressed in butterfly collared shirts and pants that look like JNCO jeans and pleated khakis had a really weird baby. There's sex in the air and Poppy wants a whiff.
Oh my God.
Scarface, 22 to 45.
Like he's a television audience demographic.
Devilishly handsome, not even a little bit Italian looking, so get that out of your dumb brain. Walks through the crowd with the confidence of a man who's going on MTV Cribs with the Ying Yang Twins one day. Does he actually have a scar on his face? Fuck no. Why would you even ask that? That's not important. What's important is that he is not at all a problematic stereotype and that he has come for his cocaine. As he approaches the red rope of the VIP, pronounced Ve A Pay in Spanish,
oh my gosh.
He spots his dear friend who is almost certainly going to become his enemy by the end of the film, Smooth Skin. Scarface yells out his signature line.
Ciao, Bella. It's me, Scarface.
Oh my